Chapter 52. Soviet Republics in Germany. The Spartacists' electoral failure in January 1919, followed by Nazca's military victory over them, was fairly general. The extreme left had managed to win some 20 seats in the Weimar Assembly, a dozen or so in Saxony, four in Württemberg, and one in Hesse. They were looking east, waiting for the Soviet army to put them into power, wrote Benoît Mechin. Although they lacked the leadership of Liebknecht and Luxembourg, they had grown in strength. Germany suffered a famine of terrible proportions. Pregnant mothers were losing their babies through sheer lack of food. The Allies had confiscated 5,000 locomotives and 150,000 railway cars, with the result that factories could no longer be supplied with coal and raw material. Millions of returned servicemen were out of work, wounded veterans were left to fend for themselves. In Berlin, there were 180,000 men out of work in January 1919, in February there were 240,000, in March 560,000, and in April more than 1 million. It was inevitable that such misery and famine would throw the masses into the hands of the agitators. The Allied politicians were too consumed with hatred to see the Soviet menace. Allied generals stationed in the occupied Rhineland were, however, sufficiently alarmed to send graphic reports. General Plumer, commander of the British occupation forces in Germany, wired this report to England on March 8, 1919. "Our troops cannot stand the sight of children dying from hunger. I beseech you to send food to Germany." Appalling figures were reaching London. At least 20% of all German babies are stillborn, and 40% who are born die within a month. Nicholson's notes reflected his anguish. "I am very tired, I feel bad, and my morale is low. What are we doing about peace? What type of peace are we after?" There is a very somber telegram from Plumer. He begs us to send food to Germany. He says our troops cannot stand to see children dying of starvation anymore. The Observer from the peace conference reports that people's complexion is yellow through malnutrition and starvation. Even Churchill recognized the German plight. "This is a very sad story." The armistice conditions prescribed that the blockade of Germany would continue. However, at the Germans' request, a clause was added that stipulated the Allies and the United States would consider sending food to Germany if it was necessary. This clause was not implemented until January 16, 1919. On the contrary, Germany's blockade was extended to the Baltic ports, thus causing the famine to increase in Germany. "I hear some painful stories about the suffering of mothers and children." The painful stories, that is, the death of 40% of Germany's babies, did not impress the Allies, however. The British blockade remained as tight as ever. During the first post-war winter, more than 1 million German children perished. The Allies were concerned only with forcing Germany to sign the Versailles Treaty. With appalling inhumanity, the Allies calculated that the tightened blockade would bring Germany to its knees at the conference table. The crowds in Berlin, Saxony, and the streets of every city in Germany did not understand this barbaric blackmail. People were dying of starvation, there was no work, and inflation was melting the German mark. The Spartacists had been trained in Moscow to exploit this national disaster. The Eberts and the Skidmans, playing the liberal bourgeois, were impotent to change anything. They offered no hope, no plan, except liberal verbiage. When people protested, they ordered the police to shoot at them. People were ready to hear another voice. Clemenceau and Tardieu were blinded to the situation by hatred, while Lloyd George and Churchill were bound by the strictures of British politics. Meanwhile, Lenin's ambassador in Berlin had been caught red-handed distributing funds to the insurrectionists. Joff was distributing money through Hasse, a German communist deputy, in order to provoke the revolution. Skidmann, The Collapse, page 247. Lenin's agent had been expelled from Germany but continued to organize subversion through radio messages. Communist insurrectionists were on the offensive throughout Germany. Communist communes and local dictatorships were springing up everywhere. Every town and village was declared an autonomous republic with responsibility for supplying food and even conducting foreign affairs, wrote Scheidemann. Immediately an establishment of Red Commissars and petty bureaucrats put themselves on the payroll of the taxpayers. They had, said Socialist Minister Barth, perverted the revolution to a question of salary. They had become greedy stockholders of the revolution. People appeared from everywhere, added Scheidemann, to claim their share of the revolutionary pie and jockey for position. The German communists had in fact invented the system of nomenklatura whereby a chosen few sponged on the majority of the people. The system has been in force in the Soviet Union ever since. 750,000 nomenklatura members live in luxury off 250 million people. The Leninist insurrectionists would, after establishing their Soviet republics, proceed to commit horrible massacres in order to purge undesirable elements. The anti-communist volunteers had the choice of fighting back or being slaughtered. The Leninists had released violent criminals from jail and had enlisted them to perform the more grisly atrocities. Germany had become a communist jungle. For 3 months, unrelenting violence gripped the nation with fear. The people were now at the mercy of communist killers. German patriots who could still think for themselves knew they had to roll back the Bolsheviks before the final meeting at Versailles. They had 6 months to reverse the tide. The regional Soviets would soon find their massacres counterproductive. No sooner had the Berlin communists been crushed than Bremen was put to the sword. The communists took control of the port in order to intercept any vessel that might contain food. These vessels were mostly sent by a charitable institution called the Hoover Commission. The delivery of food meant the difference between life and death for countless starving children. Yet it was official communist policy to exploit and compound starvation in order to start the class war. Benoît Mechin wrote. Since January 10, 1919, a hardly disguised dictatorship was established in Bremen. The socialist treasury, as well as the socialist newspaper, was seized by the communists. The banks were held up and emptied of their contents. Returning veterans were greeted with a hail of machine gun fire. The survivors were taken prisoner. Shipyards and docks were sealed off with barbed wire. Squads of Red Militia were ordered to shoot anyone attempting to resume work. While the country was dying of starvation, the Hoover Commission ships, loaded with food, were in the hands of the communists. L'Armée Allemande, pages 185-186. The ports of Hamburg and Cuxhaven were similarly taken over by the communists. 70,000 workers were kept from work by the Red Terror. Noske was overwhelmed by numbers. His naval iron brigade numbered 1,600 men, his Gerstenberg division numbered 1,900. He faced more than 100,000 communist troops with his 3,500 men. Worse news was brought to Noske. Communist agitators had taken over the huge Ruhr coal fields and were solidarizing with Bremen and Hamburg. They would cut off Germany's coal supplies. Noske advised the frightened socialist government, if order is not immediately restored in Bremen, the government can consider itself lost. It will have forfeited all respect. It is better to risk anything than accept this outrage. Noske, Memoirs, page 42. Against all odds, Noske led his Gerstenberg division of 1,900 men to Bremen on February 3, 1919. After 3 days of ferocious fighting, Noske managed to recapture Bremen and the communist agitators were put to death. The Soviets of Hamburg and Bremerhaven rushed reinforcements but were mowed down by Noske's soldiers. Noske kept the initiative and after a lightning attack forced Red Hamburg to capitulate. The port was reopened and food finally got through. 3,500 patriots had routed 100,000 Moscow-backed communists. Noske had courage and leadership qualities, which the Marxists lacked. The workers were amazed to see their Red leaders run away at the first shot, leaving them as cannon fodder. While the fire was being extinguished in the North Sea ports, the Ruhr and Westphalia were exploding in violence. The communists made the tactical error of choosing regional revolutions instead of aiming at a national insurrection. This gave Noske the chance to put down the insurrections one by one with his outnumbered forces. The communist-controlled Union of the Ruhr demanded the nationalization of the coal mines. The Weimar politicians had, with characteristic cowardice, given in and made concessions just short of communization. The Marxist agitators were still not satisfied and organized strike after strike. The miners were only allowed to work 17 days out of 90. By February 6, 1919, the communists were enforcing a general strike for the whole region. 3 days later, they declared the Ruhr the independent Northwest Republic. All coal shipments to the rest of Germany, which was enduring one of the most severe winters on record, were stopped. Once again, Noske was called to liberate German soil from the alien grip of communism. His little contingent of 2,750 volunteers faced 150,000 Red militiamen armed to the teeth. At the Hervais Dorte town hall, his men outflanked the Red cannons and were poised for attack. The Reds announced they would flood the coal mines if Noske attacked them. This would mean the mines would be out of commission for years. Noske kept his head and ceased all hostilities. He calculated that time was working to his advantage. Since the communists had cut off real communications, the Ruhr population could not be supplied with food. The general strike had cost the workers more than 100 million marks. In a few weeks, they had lost the capacity to buy food even at black market rates. Noske's right-hand man, General von Water, felt the wives and children of the miners would help bring sanity back. He negotiated directly with the men. They would work the mines and resume coal shipments in exchange for food. Noske avoided a bloodbath by using psychology. No sooner had the Ruhr crisis been averted than Westphalia fell into the hands of Kilian, the Jewish Bolshevik dictator. Operating from the city of Halle, Kilian seized 50,000 rifles, 1 million rounds of ammunition and a number of machine guns from the old army depot. His revolutionary council enforced a general strike and jailed all railway workers. The schools, the newspapers, the utilities and medical services were shut down. Even the sanitation workers were ordered not to work, which left the town in a state of filth and squalor. Noske asked General Merker to beat back this new insurrection with 3,500 volunteers. Merker approached the town of Gotha, which had just seceded from Germany, on March 1, 1919. The communists derailed one of his trains and savagely massacred the wounded. The officers were mutilated beyond recognition, dragged through the streets and publicly thrown in the river Saale, where they drowned. Merker just escaped with his life. The communists had converted the town's theater into an impregnable fortress. Merker was trying to avoid further bloodshed and sent a truce emissary, Colonel von Kluwer, to negotiate with the Revolutionary Council. Before he could talk, the communists seized him, broke his jaw and most of his ribs. A screaming communist mob dragged him through the same streets his fellow officers had been dragged the day before. With blood gushing from his multiple wounds, he was thrown into the Saale River. Still alive, he desperately attempted to swim ashore. Each time the communists kicked him back into the water. Finally, they finished him off with bullets. The outrage perpetrated on Colonel von Kluwer convinced Merker that negotiations were now out of the question. He sent his best soldiers to clear the streets. 123 communists were killed, Merker lost 7 men. The communists panicked and went on a looting rampage. Merker took 500 of them prisoners. Within 72 hours, the Red militias were routed and made illegal. Merker restored order by March 7. Bremen, Westphalia, and Halle had been retaken. The Soviet agents in Berlin were seething over this triple blow. They decided to launch another insurrection in Berlin itself. The professional agitators spread the word, workers. Proletarians. These are our orders, absolute discipline. Cold-blooded calm. Iron will. Everybody prepare to fight. The communists declared a general strike through a new front, the workers' councils. This would be the fourth revolution in 4 months. Now Noske was on his own ground and he would handle the communists himself. He asked for and received full power to quell the insurrection. On the first night the communists seized the police stations and looted the stores. On March 4, 1919 Noske stormed the Red Stronghold in Spandau. For 20 hours the fighting raged in the streets of the Spandau district. Noske won the battle there but still had to face Navy mutineers from Bremen and Hamburg, who had been in Berlin since the middle of November, 1918. They had ample ammunition and were operating from the exits of Berlin subway. Dislodged from their guns and grenades, they retreated to the Red Stronghold of Marstal, which became the target of intensive fire. A few hours later, they raised the white flag. The second and more formidable stronghold was the Volksmarinehaus. Merker gathered a small air squadron to drop naval torpedoes on the fortress. The wall were breached and Noske sent in his men. Inside they found 126 machine guns, 5,000 additional guns and rifles and two heavy artillery pieces. For another 50 hours, ferocious fighting would take place in practically every street of Berlin. Gradually Noske was closing in on the last and main bastion of communism in Berlin, Lichtenberg. The communists had terrorized the working-class district of Lichtenberg after seizing the police building and other public offices along with 80 policemen and government soldiers. The local newspapers were also seized, which seems to have infuriated the other Berlin newspapers. There were headlines announcing that all 80 policemen and soldiers had been massacred, which was officially confirmed by the Interior Minister. The news sent a shock wave through an already shock-proof Berlin. Noske declared by means of posters that anyone caught with weapons would be shot immediately. The government guard went further, any individual caught with arms in his house will be shot on the spot. The news of the massacre was in that case inaccurate, there had only 5 policemen assassinated. So many massacres had taken place in the previous weeks that the press headlines had been accepted at face value. Within hours, hundreds of communists would be killed. There would also be heavy government casualties. By March 11, 1919, the communist force of 10,000 men had dwindled to 4,000. At last, the communist high command in the Lichtenberg town hall fell, the last insurrectionists were mowed down by machine gun. The Red Commissar Dorenbach managed to escape, but was killed a month later. The fourth Bolshevik uprising had been the most murderous, 10,400 civilians were killed and wounded. It was 10,400 too many, but it would have been 100,000 if the Bolsheviks had conquered Berlin as they did Moscow. The following day Noske addressed the Reichstag in Weimar, for 1 week the battle raged in all its horror. I can tell you that the insurrection has been crushed. If the communists had failed, it was not because they lacked fighters. They were never short of men. Some of the people they enlisted fought with courage. They were torn by hunger and poverty, convinced they were fighting the right war. The dangers for Germany and Europe were immense. The crowds, thirsting for justice, were badly let down by their Marxist leaders. From Liebknecht to Thälmann in 1933, the failure of Red leadership in Germany was constant. Had there been a German Lenin or even a German Trotsky, Clemenceau would have ended his career in Siberia. The insurrection may have been crushed in Berlin, but communist uprisings continued in other parts of Germany. 3 weeks after Berlin, Magdeburg and Braunschweig were in the throes of insurrection. On April 2, 1919, a communist force of 2,000 men took over Magdeburg and declared themselves and the city a Soviet republic. They broke all relations with the German government and announced their alliance with Moscow. The socialists, formerly so friendly with the communists, found themselves being beaten up and thrown out of windows. Once more they bleated for Noske to come and save them. Socialist politicians and bureaucrats were imprisoned, while convicted criminals were set free. Once again food stores were looted and factories closed, including those of the giant industrial cartel Krupp. The Reds took a federal minister, a general, and a number of officers as hostages, liable to be shot at any time. Noske, exasperated, roared that he would never tolerate such practices or the dismemberment of Germany. On April 12, he delivered an ultimatum to the Soviet Republic of Magdeburg to surrender. Noske entrusted Merker to implement the ultimatum. Far from surrendering, the insurrectionists waged a furious battle against the government forces, killing 37 men. Merker counterattacked with great speed and managed to free the hostages. Another Leninist regime was put down and a patriotic government was put in place. General von Kleist, the freed hostage, reviewed the troops in Magdeburg the next day. Merker had organized the parade but had to leave in a hurry for the Braunschweig region, where a Jewish tailor called Merges had overthrown the government and had become the Bolshevik dictator of Braunschweig. He had enlisted the Kiel mutineers, who were living in the ducal palace, as his bodyguards. Merges had armed the communists' troops with large quantities of weapons seized in government arsenals and claimed he was forming the embryo of a powerful Red Army. He had broken with the central government, closed down the railways, stopped food supplies, and had just declared that Braunschweig was now part of the communist Third International, run by Moscow. Merker probed the surroundings, with minor skirmishing ensuing. Some 30 communists were killed and 70 taken prisoner. Merker encircled the city. His troops were ordered to give no quarter to all who resisted. Suddenly, Merker was confronted by an extraordinary spectacle. A huge crowd was running in his direction, with cries of joy and thanks addressed to their liberators. The people of Braunschweig had overrun the Red militias and had come to greet Merker and his men to the hymn of Deutschland über alles. It was Easter Day. The day of resurrection was symbolic for Braunschweig. Merker recalled, "The crowd was so thick that I could hardly proceed, my horse was sinking in an avalanche of flowers." Merker entered Braunschweig with the band leading the way. There was the proof. In Germany, as in Russia, the revolution was run by Jewish agitators determined to impose communism by force on the unwilling majority. Violence, terror, and Dark Age barbarism were their modus operandi, but at the first opportunity people would throw off the Marxist yoke. Braunschweig's Red Commissars fled the popular wrath while the rank and file chose surrender. Merker wisely decided on a show of leniency. "I judge it opportune to make their detention as light as possible." He was now free to look to Bavaria, which had become a Soviet republic under the dictatorship of three Jews, Levine, and Axelrod, sent by Lenin from Moscow. There was also the matter of a new Soviet republic that had just sprung up in Hungary.